So on page 121 near the bottom it says, do not turn the gods into demons. What does that mean? Let's have a look. When displeased, the worldly gods cause harm. The gods are supposed to be beneficial in general, so if they do cause harm, then they become demons. Similarly, mind training is supposed to subdue self-grasping. Avoid, therefore, becoming inflated by its practice and generating conceited thoughts such as, I am an excellent practitioner of mind training. Others lack this spiritual practice. Avoid ridiculing and insulting others out of a sense of superiority. If practitioners strengthen their grasping at the self-existence of phenomena, their practice becomes an endeavor of the enemy. It becomes the act of allowing a thief to escape in the forest while looking for his footprints on a rocky mountain. Avoid all such conduct, and by disgracing to self-grasping, ensure that the medicine is applied right where the illness is. Comport yourself as the lowest of the low among the servants of all sentient beings. So what it means to turn a god into a demon means, I think, as we've seen a few times already, don't allow our mind training practice to be hijacked by the ego and we become a spiritual ego. That's the demon, I think, that we're talking about here. So to talk a little bit more about that, 251 in Alan Wallace's book. While engaging in this mind training, we are emulating the awareness and conduct of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, likened here to gods. But it is possible to reduce such practice to the level of a demon when it results in an exalted sense of self. I am special or I am holy. The notions of my dharma is pure, my way is the only right way, or I am a pure practitioner, all bring the god of dharma down to the level of the demon of egotism. The practices of mind training are all designed as antidotes for the afflictions of our mind. That is what it is all about. So again, I think that is fairly straightforward. And it says, comport yourself as the lowest of the low among the servants of all sentient beings. So I think that relates back to that Tibetan saying I think I briefly mentioned before, was that the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. It grows in the low fertile valleys. So here, the lowest of the low is not allow our spiritual practice to strengthen our ego and become spiritual ego and have a lot of arrogance and pride, thinking we're someone special, we're better than others, but rather to develop humility. And I think this is what it's being mentioned here. Then the last slogan of point six is, do not seek misery as a means to happiness. This refers to not drawing personal gratification from others' miseries. Do not, for example, harbor thoughts such as, if my spouse or this particular friend dies, their family lineage will come to an end. If the wealthy benefactor becomes ill or dies, I will have the opportunity to accumulate merit and roots of virtue. If my meditator colleague of this region dies, I alone will have the opportunity to accumulate merit. Or if this enemy dies, I will enjoy happiness. The master said that since sentient beings are beings experience their own individual merits, no matter where they go due to karma, you'll find the enemies and friends. So I think this one is fairly obvious, that not to take pleasure out of other people's misfortunes. Rather, if other people are suffering, have misfortune, then to develop compassion and try to help them in whatever way we can. And then just to summarize, that's the last slogan in point six, the commitments of mind training. So just to summarize this section six before we go on to the last section, the precepts of mind training. So just to summarize reading from this book again here, The Practice of Lojong on 196. The commitments of this sixth Lojong point are about arresting common human traits that are in fact quite unhelpful to us in both our spiritual practices and our everyday lives. If we fail to pay attention to them, our mind training practices will be corrupted or curtailed and we'll fail to derive any real benefit from them. We often neglect to pay sufficient attention to these traits because their familiarity and frequency seduce us into thinking they are of little real consequence. So the full virulence of their harmful effects manages to slip under our radar. From our deluded samsaric standpoint, it may seem that many of these traits are necessary for our own well-being, self-esteem, and self-worth. Talking about others' defects may make us appear more desirable, or gossiping about others' misfortunes may make our own misery seem less. But we have to examine these tendencies much more closely to see that this is a completely mistaken aspect of our lives. This Lojong point is emphasizing the fact that despite having a good motivation and the best intentions, our mind training will have little success if we don't commit ourselves strongly enough to undermining these traits. These tendencies don't bring us any self-confidence or happiness. In fact, they undermine our personal autonomy and well-being and obstruct our spiritual progress. It's important to put an end to these negative and paranoid tendencies and replace them with love, compassion, and the development of a kind heart. Kind-heartedness is one of the central premises of the Kadampa tradition, as the following anecdotal story by Patril Rinpoche illustrates. Patril Rinpoche is a great modern-day Tibetan master who said, he's quoting him here, he says, "A teacher always placed a unique emphasis on the importance of a kind heart. And rather than ask people, 'How are you?' he would say, 'Has your heart been kind?'" So let's now go to the seventh and last of the 7 points. So before we do that, is any last questions?
Ghosts as an illustration, spirits as an illustration, some mantra to not hit them, not harm them, and things like that.
Yeah.
While I consider all these texts to be very scientific, and as far as reincarnation is concerned, I believe they are very strong because of whatever study I have done, I am not able to relate to this at all.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it actually happens, and is there some text or book that you would recommend? Because I mean, somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama in his book has spoken about his guardian angel, and when he's coming, he's talking about medium, drawing the way and the route. Many, many times these references come. It will just help me strengthen my belief that there is something beyond.
Yeah.
What is your view on this?
Well, this diagram here up on the wall, this wheel of life, part of that is to depict the different types of existences that are possible, and generally it's divided into 6 sections, which are called the 6 realms, 6 types of existences. 2 of those 6 we can confirm. 1 is human, the other is the animal realm. So those 2 we know exist, we see. There are 4 others mentioned there. There's what's called the Deva and Asura realm, which are often translated as like God realm or God demigod, but nothing, not like creator God, Christian God. And in the text here, I think it used the word celestial. So these types of existences are not having a body like this. They're having like very subtle body, light body. They have a lot of pleasures, enjoy a lot of pleasures and so forth. That's why it's often translated as God realm. Then there's the other 2, which is called Preta realm and Narak realm. And in those realms, they tend to have a lot of suffering, physical, mental suffering. And so the Preta realm is often trapped because they can't even get enough food and drink and things like that in this type of existence. Often that's translated as something like hungry spirit or hungry ghost realm. And then the Narak realm is immense suffering, physical suffering. So often that's translated as hell realm, but not really the Christian idea of hell. So these are six types of existences within that are possible. And of course the idea of rebirth, there are many traditions that talk about rebirth. I mean, even in Christianity we talk about going to heaven and hell. And in some traditions they say you're always born a human. Some traditions say you're always moving, improving in every life. The Buddhist assertion is that there's many beyond being human, and where we end up depends on how we lead our life. So of those four, I've never seen a being in the Deva, Asura, Narak, Preta realm. There are quite a number of humans who claim to be able to directly perceive these beings, so for them, their reality, they're confirmed. And of course, this diagram was coming from the Buddha himself, and in some of the Buddha's own teachings, he talks about in past life, in this type of this existence, he did this and so forth. So he...
Query is not about reincarnation. Yeah. That, I think there's a lot of scientific evidence to say that we can't disprove it, so there's a fair degree of belief in that, but on the ghosts and the spirits...
Right. So, what we need to do is to understand these types of existences, and to understand them well, if we understand the idea of emptiness, dependent, arising, that everything's a product of our mind, then they're not so hard to relate to. I mean, still we don't perceive them directly, but, you know, like the Narak realm is simply a realm where we experience immense suffering. So, you know, we have that type of experience in our human life. You know, if we have extreme physical or mental pain, we have this heavy mental, heavy experience. So in that sense, that experience we have in the human existence is more or less very similar to that experience. And when we look at our human life, this idea of emptiness is saying there is no fixed, independent, objective reality. So that the experience we have is the product of our mind. So us experiencing some heavy physical suffering versus experiencing that same experience for a bit longer and having a bit different looking body, there's not much difference. And so this is what it said, is that, you know, in terms of the rebirth, if we do a lot of heavy negative actions, then rather than in the human realm experiencing some heavy suffering for a short time, we will experience that for a longer time and the body might look a bit different. So that's what it means. That's all it means.
That's again saying that the Narka realm is a projection of the mind.
So is the human realm. So is the animal realm. They're all a projection of the mind.
But the ghosts and spirits, the way it is described is as if there was something, it was not just a projection. You know, it is said there is a medium.
But
the Tibetan Book of the Dead also has these very
projections
of pictures of ghosts. They're like, they're drawn like...
But I am a projection of your mind. Aren't I? Aren't I, do I exist independent of you? I mean, what did we see in the emptiness practice there? There is no other person existing independent of us. They exist within our conceptual framework. So just like humans and trees and everything are dependent arisings existing within that conceptual framework, so are all these other beings. There's no difference within all of those.
Exactly. For example, for me, reincarnation is not a mental projection. For me, it's a scientific fact. That's the way I...
Yeah, but mental projection is scientific fact, according to Buddhism. That's the thing. Is that mental projection doesn't mean somehow they're not real. That's what it means to be real. That everything is mental projection. Everything is a dependent arising. That is the Buddhist view of reality. So there is no hell realm under the ground here. There is no Deva realm in the sky over there. That's not how things exist.
And even the ghosts and the spirits are not anywhere else.
They could be here. But, so what this is saying is that all of these beings, a lot of these beings, because of the nature of our physical eye, we can't see them because they have subtle bodies. But some people claim to be able to have that ability to see these beings. So there could be these beings right here. We don't know. That's the Buddhist assertion. And the Buddhist assertion is that as we purify our mind, we will come to see these beings directly ourselves. that it's not that difficult to have that experience. That's the Buddhist assertion. But that's what it means with talking about all these different types of beings. They're just another form of existence that we can't now, with our physical eye, see because it's a little too subtle for us. That's the Buddhist assertion.
There are ghosts, is that what you say?
Well, ghosts, I mean, if you want to use the word ghost to translate the preta realm, then you can call the pretas ghosts. But sometimes when we use these words, we have some fanciful idea from our childhood days what that means. So we need to be a little bit careful about the use of these words like ghosts, angel, god, and not to have some strange idea what that implies. These are often English words used to talk about these types of realms.
Separate mental consciousness.
Yes.
Separate flow of mental consciousness that exists is what you're saying.
Yes, yes.
I'm wondering if any of the Tibetan schools actually, you know, recognize that they've adapted something from the Bön tradition, or do they just...
Of course. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Because I've heard that they've discredited it.
No, I mean, they've taken a lot of stuff on, but only in terms of the aspect of practice, not in terms of the nature of reality and so forth. Yes, of course.
I got two questions, just two different ones. First is, can we consider, you know, the ghost realm and God realm like a metaphor? I mean,
absolutely, if you're quite welcome to do that. I mean, in all of these realms, even the animal realm, we can use as a metaphor for our human existence, that we also live like an animal sometimes. So even the animal realm we can use as a metaphor, for sure, all of them.
Okay, and if we do not, I mean, if we consider it real, I mean that it really exists, then we get two realms, like animal realm and human realm. And so what is the Buddhist point on evolution then? What is the point of view on evolution?
Well, it's just the physical change. So there's no problem with evolution. Well, so remember, these realms are just concepts. So like trees and plants and seeds, if we hold on to them too tight, we sort of lose the idea. They're just concepts to understand all the different possibilities. So in all those possibilities, we say, oh, this is sort of human, here's animal, and the same idea. Yeah. Otherwise, we have... end up with some strange ideas.
Yeah,
So again, these are just sort of six types of existences. I mean, of course, within that, we could make a list of 10, 50, 100, 1,000 types of existences. I mean, even in the animal realm, we could do, oh no, there's birds, there's things that fly, there's animals, there's things that are under the ground, there's fish. I mean, we can divide the animal realm into, you know, thousands of types of existences if we want. So where we draw the lines is arbitrary, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's move on now then. Seventh point. So here we're talking about the precepts of mind training. So precepts here is about the things that support and nurture our mind training practice. Yeah. So it says here, since your mind training will not degenerate, but will in fact take you to progressively higher levels, you should engage in the practice of this teaching. So again, it's things that support and nurture our practice. So the first point here on 122 is accomplish all yogas through a single means. It says here, other spiritual practices have their own particular dietary requirement, modes of conduct, and so on, in addition to their yogic practices. For those who have entered the door of this mind training practice, it is sufficient to engage in all activities, those such as those pertaining to food, solely by keeping in mind this mind training practice. So you should engage in this practice. Which means what it's saying here is that some traditions have lots of various practices that are different add-on practices. But here it's saying in mind training, everything we do is through a single means. And the single means, of course, is the two bodhicittas, is wisdom and compassion. So whatever we do, we apply that single means, wisdom and compassion, in all of our activities. So to describe that a bit more, or go back to Alan Wallace here, page 253. Whatever happens, use the mind training to transform your experience into the two bodhicittas, the heart of the practice. Just as it is possible to reduce the spiritual to the mundane by letting the God fall to the level of a demon, it is possible to transform mundane into spiritual practice. It is possible to turn grocery shopping, working, relaxing, and taking care of children into spiritual practice. Driving becomes spiritual practice by sending the wish to your fellow travelers, may you all get to your destination swiftly and safely, instead of being irritated with traffic and wishing others, get out of my way. Use imagination and transform the mundane into Dharma. It is possible. Okay. There we go. Some advice for when we're stuck in traffic on the way to work. And related to that one is the next point here. It says, overcome all errors through a single means. Some who are under Mara's influence fail to develop confidence in the spiritual practice. Mara here, we can sort of externalize, or often Mara here, we can talk about the four Maras, which are actually internal Maras. And one of those is, of course, our mental afflictions, the Mara of the mental afflictions. Another Mara is our contaminated body and mind. Another Mara is our sensory attachment. Another Mara is the Mara of death. So these are all more internal Maras. So, of course, if we are under the influence of the Mara of the mental afflictions, then we may fail to develop confidence in the spiritual practice. Yeah, it's the Mara of the aggregates, the Mara of the mental afflictions, the Mara of death, and the Mara of sensual craving. They experience the false... Sorry?
What is the meaning of
Mara, I think, means like demon, or I think so. The actual word Mara, but normally the word Mara often talks about the demon, or the inner demons and outer demons. So, but the word Mara itself, I don't know, is there any Sanskrit scholars? Maybe I can look that up. But normally Mara usually they use the word demon, but I don't know if that word Mara means that or not. Okay. They experience the false perceptions of misguided meditation practice with thoughts like, since I began practicing mind training, illnesses have increased, harms from demons have increased, people have become more hostile, and afflictions such as self-grasping have increased as well. Based on such thoughts, or for no particular reason, they lose enthusiasm for mind training and are in danger of turning away. So this, I think, can be fairly common, this sort of thing, you know, oh, things have got worse, and it's not working, and I'm doing it wrong, and my mental afflictions have got worse since I started meditating. And then there's a danger we just give up and turn away from practice. So it says here, when this happens, you should become aware of it right there and then think, a misguided meditative practice has arisen in me. With a second thought, you should reflect. So here comes Tong Len again. There must be many beings like me in the universe whose thoughts have deviated from true Dharma practice. And take all of these deviations upon yourself and offer your body, wealth, and virtues to others. Imagine that because of this, the thoughts of those others turn toward the Dharma, and these others enter the unmistaken path. So again, instead of getting caught up in these negative state of mind, we can use the Tonglen practice to reverse that by developing, instead of getting caught up in it, take all of that confusion or negative state of mind from others and send then everything they need to be happy, loving kindness and compassion and so forth. So we can use also this as an opportunity for spiritual practice. So overcome all errors through a single means, again, is to overcome all errors through the single means of bodhicitta. So just like accomplishing all yogas through a single means is the bodhicitta, also here bodhicitta. And we can also here do the two bodhicittas, conventional and ultimate, of course. Okay. So then we'll move on to the next slogan. So here, in this slogan, there's, I think, a lot of practical advice. Some of this we've come across already, particularly in the fifth point about the five powers. So let's have a look at that. It says there are two tasks, one at the start and one at the end. In the morning, after getting up, you should practice the thought, throughout this day, I shall make sure I don't become tainted by the clinging of self-cherishing. I shall make sure that thoughts cherishing others do not degenerate. So this is like the propelling intention, you know, the first of the five powers. Then, through the day, remain sustained by the vigilance that accomplishes everyday activity. So again here, this means to, a little bit like the acquaintance or familiarity, is to have vigilance and to make sure that everything we do in daily life is sustained by the wisdom and compassion. Then, when going to bed at night, while in meditative absorption, lion's majestic pose, so we saw that in the death process, lying on the right side, sequentially review the day by recalling, first I did this, and then I did that, and so on. If you detect any transgression, it is stated, at that instant, enumerate your flaws and recall your teacher's instructions. Then cultivate the following thought. Isn't it amazing that there are people like me who waste their precious human existence and bring harm upon themselves? Thinking thus, appeal for forbearance, declare and purify your negative karma and cultivate the resolve to forsake this in the future. So this is basically saying all of this then at the end of the day, before we go to bed, then to review our day. How did our day go? And if we notice that we've done any negative actions during the day, then we can use the four opponent powers to purify that action, to have some regret for having done that action, to reaffirm our positive direction. If we're Buddhist, that can be in terms of refuge and bodhicitta. Think of some sort of remedy, practical remedy for that negative behavior, and then make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. So therefore, we can do this as a very practical way of purifying negativities at the end of the day. And then it says, if you have not committed any transgression, then rejoice, thinking, I have indeed made my human existence meaningful. So here, I think it's also important to have a balanced view of the day, not just focus on the negative things, but to focus on the positive things we did during that day, and then to rejoice in any positive actions we did during that day, and then also to make a strong determination to continue to do these positive things in the future, the next day and so on. So this is a very good way to finish the day. And these were, of course, some practices that were mentioned earlier as well in terms of purifying negativity, accumulating virtue. Because in terms of accumulating virtue, then it said the lazy person's way of accumulating virtue is to rejoice in our own and others' good actions. So I think this is very helpful to really increase our positive habits, so to do this at the end of every day. Then it says, dedicate the virtues toward the aspiration to realize this practice in your mental continuum. Also make the aspirational prayer, may I never be divorced from the two awakening minds throughout all lives. So again, this is the five powers, of course, the aspirational prayer is to aspire to continue to practice these two bodhicittas, and also we can make that aspiration to meet qualified teachers to help us to do this. So here we see a lot of the elements from the daily life practice that we saw in the five powers. So that is the slogan, two tasks, one at the start and one at the end. Of course, one at the start is the motivation, the aspiration to the propelling intention, and the one at the end, of course, is the dedication and the aspirational prayer to continue to do these actions again in the future. Then if we move to the next slogan, question, yes. Well, of course, ideally we would do this for every activity. So every time we're about to do a virtuous activity, we would have the propelling intention to have the motivation of wisdom and compassion. And then at the end of the activity to dedicate and to make the aspiration to continue to do that. So it's not just at the end, beginning and end of every day. We can do at the level of each activity. Of course, in a practical sense, it's a good way to start the day in that way, and it's a good way to finish the day. So this is good. Of course, someone who's at that level of practice, probably you're going to be finding that spontaneously wisdom and compassion are arising in their mind in every moment. So they don't really need to consciously set the propelling intention and to do these things that we need to do consciously now, because by that time, all of this has become spontaneous. It's always there anyway. But for us at our level, of course, we need to generate that because it's not spontaneous within us. Yeah.
Yeah. If you are a relative beginner and you apply all this, or you try to apply all this, and you go back in a working environment where, you know, there's nobody maybe who is really training the mind. And for example, if I go for a meeting, everybody, is going to talk, just because of self-sharing, motivation, and they talk and talk. And if you get aware of all those, if you observe this in every person, you observe this and you start to get sensitive to this and this motivation. And then second, you also listen to the content of what they're saying, and you also observe yourself reaction to all this. So you have three levels of observation during a situation, and I realize that I get completely exhausted and somehow a little bit too difficult.
Exactly. So therefore, and that's going to come up a little bit later as well, we need sangha. We need spiritual community. We need support as a beginner. Because as a beginner, we know that we are faced with we're bombarded by all sorts of stimulus in our life. And a lot of this stimulus is not very positive, and we are often overwhelmed by it, and it perpetuates our own reactive mind. So therefore, to begin to change that, we need some support, some help. Of course, we need to meditate and internalize and stabilize the mind and do all of these things. But the reality is, for most of us as a beginner, often, unfortunately, the environment we live in has a very heavy negative impact on us. And to even begin to change that, we need support and help. We need sangha. So therefore, I think for most of us as a beginner, to try to think that we can do this on our own when we go home, I think, based on my own experience and experience of many people, it's probably going to be too difficult. So therefore, we need help. We need to get involved, connected with other people who are trying to do something similar to us. That can be in the context of a formal group, like a Buddhist center or something, or it could be just simply a group of people that you're connecting with. that also trying to do some meditation, trying to also implement some of these ideas, and to get involved with them, spend time regularly, a couple of times a week, meditate a bit, discuss a bit, get some support from them. Otherwise, it's going to be almost impossible. And one other point I think that's coming up in one of the slogans soon is, as a beginner, one short-term strategy can be, if there are certain situations or certain people that always overwhelm us in a negative way whenever we come into contact with it, then maybe it's good to try to give ourselves a little bit of distance from them as a beginner, because otherwise we just continually get overwhelmed. Of course, unfortunately, sometimes the very people who overwhelm us in a negative way are family. And it's hard to sort of step back a little bit. But if we can, as a beginner, maybe give ourselves a bit of physical distance from these people, or also situations, you know. Maybe there's certain situations that we always get caught up in a lot of craving or aversion or something. You know, to give ourselves a little bit of physical distance from these situations. I'm not talking about abandoning people. Of course, we need to keep them close to our heart, but maybe we need some physical distance so that we don't always get overwhelmed. So to give ourselves a bit of time and space to work on our own mind, so that we strengthen our own mind, so that later we can go into these very heavy situations and not be overwhelmed by them. So I think this is something very important as a beginner, these two things that can be very helpful. Yeah.
Let's say we are in a situation that is really overwhelming.
Get out.
As a beginner, it's
well, best. I mean, we have to evaluate every situation on its own merit. Yeah. But I mean, if we are in a situation where we're about to really do something heavy, negative, verbal or physical, and we can't restrain ourselves, maybe we have to go out, get out. Of course, this is not a solution, but it could be a short-term strategy that avoids heavy negative consequences. So we may need to just, of course, you know, we can do things like, if we're about to say something really heavy, negative, stop and take a couple of deep breaths first, or, you know, we can try these approaches. But in the end, if we're about to really do something heavy, negative, maybe we have to just get out of that scenario. That's sort of the last ditch method. It's not the first thing, of course, because if we use that as our first line strategy, it means every time there's something difficult, we just escape, we're just avoiding. We're not actually learning to deal with difficult situations. But as the last ditch strategy, it may be necessary in some circumstances. Okay, then we move on to the next point. It says, forbear whichever of the two arises. So what that means is, whether we end up in a good situation or not such a good situation, we should not react with attachment to the good situations, aversion to the unpleasant situation. So let's look at the commentary. If you suddenly come into a great fortune, do not become arrogant or become attached to it. Make sure you do not fall prey to the 8 mundane concerns. So again, the 8 worldly concerns is having craving and attachment for the pleasant things, having aversion to the unpleasant things. You should take this fortune as a basis for your Dharma practice. Some people who attract followers and material gifts become conceited by this. They then despise others and do whatever comes to mind. You must discard such behavior. So again, what that's saying is that if we come into a good situation, maybe we happen to get a lot of praise or material wealth or material gifts or a lot of pleasure, is not to get caught up with that, with craving and attachment and clinging. That's just going to derail our spiritual practice. Rather, use those good conditions for a good purpose. Likewise, if you experience misfortune, such as that the only thing that seems beneath you is the water flowing under a bridge, do not become depressed or demoralized, wondering how such an unfortunate person like me could exist. Do not be so downcast that you are incapable of training the mind. Instead, reflect, compared to the contrast and degree intensity between the happiness of the higher realms and the suffering of lower realms existence, the contrast between pleasant and unpleasant states of human existence is not so immense. So without further distraction, I shall focus on my spiritual practice. For it is taught, even if you are prosperous like the gods, pray not be conceited. Even if you become destitute as a hungry ghost, pray not to become disheartened. So what this is basically saying here is, don't get caught up in hope and fear. Don't get caught up with attachment to the pleasant experiences, fear, worry, aversion to the unpleasant experiences. Because if we do, then our whole practice will go astray. We can use all situations as suitable conditions for Dharma practice. Of course, if we have good conditions, good things, we can use those. Even if we have adverse things, unpleasant things happening to us, we can also use those in our spiritual practice. So that's what it means to forbear in whatever too arises, is to not get caught up in craving and attachment to the pleasant things, aversion, fear, anxiety, and so forth, to the unpleasant experiences. Then the next, guard the two even at the cost of your life. Here it says, these are one, the precepts and commitments presented in the teachings in general. So this is talking about what we talked about yesterday, the basically precepts and commitments in terms of adopting ethical lifestyle to support our practice. You know, these pratimoksha vows and the bodhisattva vows and so forth. And then the commitments of this particular mind training teaching, such as do not speak of the defects of others. So here we're talking about that sixth point, the one we just mentioned. So it says that since even the mundane happiness of the present life will elude you, if these two commitments may become degenerate, hold them more dearly than your life. So remember, therefore, to maintain these commitments for mind training and any commitments that we've taken in general practice. Because these are the things that are sustaining, that are protecting our practice. If we don't maintain these, we end up engaging in behavior that will go against our practice. So I think this is fairly obvious. Well, here we're talking precepts. Precepts are talking about things that support and nurture the practice, and then the commitments or the vows are a lot to do about avoiding things that go against practice. But sometimes these words are used interchangeably, depending on who's translating. But generally, here what we're saying is commitment is, as we saw in the sixth point, commitments is about things, avoiding certain things that go against the practice, and precepts here is about engaging in things that support and nurture the practice. I mean, both of them collectively, of course, are necessary to do the practice well, but one is talking about what to avoid, and the other one is talking about what to engage in to support the practice.
When they speak on the bodhisattva vows, they speak about what to avoid or what to engage?
Both. You'll get both of them in there. About what to avoid and what to do to support the practice. I think both are there present. Okay, then if we go on to the next, it says, train in the three difficult challenges. So this is all about challenges in terms of, as it says here, to eliminate mental afflictions. It says, when eliminating the afflictions, in the beginning, it can be difficult to remember the antidotes. So in the beginning, of course, it can be difficult not only just to remember the antidotes, it could be difficult even to recognize that a mental affliction has arisen, and that even if a mental affliction has arisen, it could be difficult to remember what to do with that, how to overcome it. In the middle, it can be difficult to overcome the mental affliction. So even though we've recognized what to do, it could be actually difficult to actually overcome it. And then at the end, it can be difficult to eradicate the continuum of afflictions, meaning that it can be difficult to reduce and eliminate the habit of that mental affliction coming up again. Therefore, make sure you accomplish these three without great difficulty. To train, first thing in the morning, put on the armor with respect to all these three stages. So what does it mean to put on the armor with respect to all these three stages? To put on the armor, of course, we need to have a determination to deal with the mental afflictions. So part of the armor is having the determination to work to reduce the mental afflictions. And of course, part of that armor needs to be mindfulness. Because if we don't have mindfulness, even if we have the determination to overcome the mental afflictions will arise without really us seeing them, and they will completely overwhelm us. And by that time, then we can't do much to overcome them because they've taken hold of our mind. So part of the armor, again, is to have the determination to want to reduce and eliminate the afflictions, plus to have the mindfulness to be able to put these things into practice. And then it says, when the afflictions actually arise, recall their antidotes, counter them, and cultivate the resolve from here on, I shall never allow the afflictions to arise in my mind. So here are the three things. First, of course, is having mindfulness, we notice when the affliction arises. Then we recall their antidotes, so that's to remember what to do. So when something arises, to remember how to overcome it. Then to counter them, to actually apply that antidote to the mental affliction. And then to eradicate the continuum of the mental afflictions, the third challenge, is to cultivate the resolve. From here on, I shall never allow the afflictions to rise in my mind. So that's the resolve from those four opponent powers, to make a strong determination not to allow that mental affliction to take hold of my mind again. And again, we can make that for a certain time period as well. So this is how to train, to, with mindfulness and determination, when a mental affliction arises, is to remember the antidote, apply the antidote, and then make strong determination to not allow that mental affliction to take hold of my mind again in the future. And then if we go to the next point, it says, adopt the three principal conditions. So this, I think, also something here can be here very important to understand. So let's see what these three principal conditions are. Top of page 125, it says, there should be a qualified spiritual teacher who possesses the pith instructions and is endowed with higher realizations. The bond between the teacher and you should be so close that no dog can come between. I think this is another Tibetan expression. And the teacher should be pleased with you. So the first principal condition is to have a qualified teacher. And of course there are many advantages with having a qualified teacher. It says here the bond between you should be so close that no dog can come between, and the teacher should be pleased with you. So here I think one good analogy to remember in terms of our relationship to the teacher. Sometimes the analogy used is how close to be to the teacher is the analogy of a fire. If we're too close to a fire, we get burnt. If we're too far from the fire, we don't receive any warmth. Likewise with our spiritual teacher, often if we're too close to the teacher, we get burnt. And if we're too far from the teacher, we don't receive any benefit, any inspiration or guidance. So too close to the teacher getting burnt means that what often happens is if people are physically too close to the teacher, maybe the teacher lives next door or they see the teacher every day, then two things often happen. One is that because we're seeing the teacher so often, we often end up projecting a lot of stuff onto the teacher that's not there. And we often project a lot of negativity in general on people. You know, we start, our sort of deluded mind starts misinterpreting a lot of things, and then often you find that we start to see a lot of faults in the teacher which are not really there. So that's one thing that can happen if we're too close. The second thing that often can happen is because we have so much easy access to the teacher, then soon as we have some little problem, some little decision to make, we simply run to the teacher and say, what shall I do? So this, of course, is not helpful because it's not making ourselves self-reliant. Of course, now as a beginner, our inner wisdom and compassion is very weak, and so we need the outer guru to awaken the inner guru within us. So we need some help from them. But if we're too much relying on them to do everything for us, to make all decisions for us, we're not developing ourselves. So that can happen if we're too close to the teacher, too much easy access. Of course, equally, if we're too far from the teacher, then we can't receive the benefit of the teacher, meaning we can't get the inspiration from the teacher, and also won't get that personal advice and guidance in when we need it. So we need that distance like the fire. So we don't need to live in the same place as the teacher, but we do need, I think it's helpful to be able to physically be in the presence of the teacher a number of times every year. That may only be 2, 3, or 4 times a year, because then we can receive the inspiration, we can receive some personal guidance, advice from the teacher, and then of course we go away and implement that advice, and then some months later we can go back and tell them how things are going, and then maybe get some new advice or some adjustment in advice. In the meantime, of course, if we face some difficulties in our practice, we can often these days with technology, we can send an email to the teacher who's probably got some, if they're a very highly qualified teacher, they've probably got hundreds of students. So their attendant will probably get the email and give it to the teacher. They know you, they've given advice back, and that email you advice back on how to overcome the problem. So in the meantime, you have that possibility. So I think this is how we can have that relationship to the teacher in a healthy way. And it said here, the teacher should be pleased with you. So what would make, and so this is talking about how to make please our teacher most. Of course, we can please the teacher by helping to support the teacher materially or financially if they need that. We can give them our time if they need that. But the thing that would please our teacher most, of course, is if we followed their advice and guidance. So that's what it means here. So, therefore, if we have this qualified teacher, they can really give us very precise instructions, tailor these instructions to our own personal needs, our own personal level. They can help us to overcome obstacles and really tailor our practice to make our practice much more effective. So here, a teacher is one of these principal conditions. Then it says, second one is, your state of mind should be such that many realizations have arisen from the rarity of precious human existence, one of the very first preliminaries, of course, to the understanding of no self, the wisdom practice. And these should have arisen as just as contemplated or as taught by your teacher. So the second point here, of course, is that we need to put these teachings into practice, that if we don't, then we're not really going to progress. So here also, if we want to be a qualified student, then we need to, part of being a qualified student is to put effort into practice, to put this advice and guidance and instructions that we're getting from the teacher into practice. Otherwise, of course, if we merely leave it as some sort of intellectual understanding, we're not going to be making any progress. So this is the second point. The second principal condition is to put these instructions we're receiving from the teacher into practice. Of course, if we don't have a teacher, then we put the general instructions that are being discussed here in the Lojong practice, the wisdom and compassion. And then the third condition, principal condition, it says, conditions conducive to Dharma practice must be gathered, such as faith, intelligence, joyous effort, a strong sense of disenchantment towards cyclic existence, food, clothing, and other necessities. So the third condition, principal condition, is we need to have assembled these conducive conditions for Dharma practice. Faith here is, of course, faith in the practice, that the understanding the benefits of the practice, to have faith that this practice is going to bring us benefit. So that will give us a lot of enthusiasm to do the practice. So this is talking about the joyous effort. So we should not see Dharma practice as some sort of hardship, but to have joyous effort through understanding the benefits of the practice. We will have faith, and then we will joyfully put effort into the practice. And of course, strong sense of disenchantment towards cyclic existence. This is the understanding of dukkha, and thereby developing renunciation. Because if we don't have this, then if we try to do Dharma practice, then there's a big danger that this practice will simply become another of the eight worldly concerns. That we'll be doing this practice to become famous, to have a lot of praise, to maybe try to accumulate wealth and pleasure and so forth. So we need to make sure that we have this healthy motivation for Dharma practice to avoid getting caught up in the eight worldly concerns. And then it talks about having food, clothing and other necessities. Generally, in this list here, there often are listed five or six things. One of these, which I've just previously mentioned, which I'll mention again now, is the idea of sangha, to have supportive sangha, spiritual community. If we don't, then probably most of us are going to find that it's going to be almost impossible to do any sort of practice when we go home, because we're going to be simply swept away by our old habits and all the stimulus around us. I know that from personal experience. So part of conducive conditions here for Dharma practice, I think for all most beginners, is definitely having some sort of spiritual community or sangha to support us in our practice. So these are the three principal conditions that we need. Have a qualified teacher, put those instructions into practice as best we can through meditation and integrating in daily life, and then to assemble conducive conditions to do that practice in the way we've just mentioned here. So then also some more practical advice on that. It said, since these are the principal conditions of Dharma practice, if you possess them, rejoice and strive especially to enhance them. Then if we don't have these conditions, what to do? Don't get despondent and despair and depressed. Rather, if you do not possess them, contemplate how sad the vast expanse of the universe must contain countless others like me who lack these three factors and have failed in their Dharma practice. Thinking thus, take upon yourself all these deficiencies as you offer your body and so on to them. Imagine they obtain the three conditions and all experience the great vehicle, the Mahayana. So again, rather than if we don't have these conditions, of course we strive to achieve them, and at the same time we can take this opportunity to strengthen our conventional bodhicitta, to strengthen our love and compassion for others, rather than get despondent and despair and depressed because we don't have these conditions. Any questions on that, and then we'll go for the lunch break. Look for a teacher.
Yeah.
Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that we, you know, found a tradition that suits us. Because if we sort of just go look for the next qualified teacher, but they happen to be in a tradition that we don't connect with and resonate with, then that's going to be very difficult. So generally, first we need to find a tradition that seems to fit our character and that seems to connect with us, and then within that tradition, then we would look for a teacher in that. There are a number of qualities that we need to look for in a qualified teacher. You know, often they are listed, these 10 qualities of things to look for in a teacher. The core elements, of course, are the ethics, concentration, wisdom, that they have to have that. And then the other two main things that are mentioned are the wisdom and compassion, as here, that the person should have great compassion in their attitude, and they should have a realization of emptiness. So these are often sort of the core things we're looking for in a teacher. How to actually find a teacher? The reality is it is very difficult to find qualified teachers, and we should not simply pick the first teacher we find that seems very charismatic, because unfortunately that happens a lot, and then people end up finding themselves relying on a teacher after some investigation later that this person is not really qualified, and maybe their motivation is dubious, and maybe they're actually being quite unethical, and they're actually just trying to manipulate, deceive people and exploit people. This unfortunately happens a lot. So we do not want to go there. So we need to check out the teacher thoroughly. Fortunately, in our modern society, we have technology that can help us. You know, we can check through the internet and so forth, and we can check from other people who've been following them for some years, and then check with other respected teachers what if they know this person and so forth. And of course, if this teacher is part of a larger organization that's been around for quite some time, is a respected organization, then more likely then that teacher will also be qualified. But it's still, we need to check them out. If the teacher is a one-person show, if they are simply, you know, not part of a larger organization, then we really need to check even more thoroughly. Yeah. Of course, there are many qualified teachers who are not part of an organization, yes. But we need to make sure that we check them very thoroughly, because it's harder to validate than whether they're qualified. And then, of course, part of that process is we go to teachings from them. We listen to them, see what they say. We start to get some little connection with them. And then over time, because not only do they need to have a lot of realization and knowledge, but they need to be able to be on the same wavelength as us. They need to be able to communicate effectively with us, because there may be a number of qualified teachers, but when you go to their teachings, you know, they're saying all the right things and so forth, but you find it difficult to follow their approach, that you don't really connect with them. So then, of course, if you follow them as a personal teacher, then you may find that it's difficult to really connect with them. So it's important also to find someone that you can connect with that can really, and that's part of the qualities of the teachers, being skilled in teaching. So all of these things we need to really check out. And then at some point we can then try to see if that teacher can be our personal teacher. And if they're already a very highly qualified teacher, it could be that they already have too many personal students and they can't really take you on as anymore because they've got too many commitments already, trying to help so many, probably hundreds of students. And then if we really do accept a personal teacher, then, and we go to ask advice, and generally to accept, it's recommended to only have one personal teacher, because if we have more than one personal teacher that we get personal advice from, there's a very much a big danger that, you know, if we go to two different teachers for personal advice and they offer what seems to be contradictory advice, then what do? And then often when we go for advice, the very thing that they tell us to do is the one thing we don't want to do, because it's the one thing we really have to work on and we've been avoiding. And so when we go to a teacher and they tell us to do this, we go, oh, I don't want to do that. And then we run off to another teacher and then keep going until we find a teacher that says something nice. This is not going to help us. So best to have one personal teacher. And also the advice is, if we go to ask for personal advice, we better be prepared to follow it. If we're not prepared to follow it, don't ask for the advice. Having said that, of course, if they give us advice and we believe that their advice is unethical, we must not follow that advice under any circumstance. We need to ask them to show to us how this advice is not unethical. And if they can't effectively show us how it's not unethical, we should not follow that advice. This is part of being a qualified student. One of the qualities of a qualified student is not to blindly follow the teacher. not to blindly follow any instruction. If we do that, we're not a qualified student. We need to check it out. Of course, if we've checked out the teacher thoroughly and they're qualified, then they won't be really giving us this advice. So we won't have that problem. But even so, we need to check out the advice first. But if it's not unethical, then we should follow it. Because otherwise, we should not have a teacher relationship because they're there to help us. And there's no point in asking for advice from a teacher if we're only going to do the things that we like to do and not what they're telling us. That then we've no point in having that student-teacher relationship. Then we might as well just go do whatever we want. Same result. Okay. We've run out of time. There may be some more questions, but let's leave it there. Break for lunch, and then we'll continue on after lunch, and there may be some more questions about the teacher or this point. So if you have some questions about these three general points, then we can bring them up at 2 o'clock. Okay, so let's break for lunch now.